Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, hey. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you doing? It's been a while since I sat in this chair.
I know. It's nice to see you there.
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you perfectly well. Good. Thank you. I'm just getting settled into my seat because I've been running around with all of these moving parts of today's show. So I'm happy to have you there organizing all of the pieces because I know that you'll give it your best shot.
I'll give it my best shot. That's all I can say.
Well, today's show, as you can imagine, has been inspired by Election Day because we can't turn it off. Every moment of the day, we've been talking about elections, being told to get out and vote, seeing stickers of everyone who's voted. Every social media post is about voting, voting, voting. And I don't know if it's just me, but I find it a little annoying, all of the emphasis on voting. I don't know if constantly barraging people with the message to go vote gets more people out to the polls. If it does, I'm all for it. That's wonderful. But every time I see these messages about voting, get out to vote, get out to vote, it's your right, let's vote, I keep thinking about how do we actually learn how to vote? You know, at what process and at what point in our lives are we learning the process of going through ballots, weighing pros and cons, figuring out what issues are most important, seeing through all of the bias and special interests? You know, this is such a fundamental right and such a fundamental part to the functioning of our democracy that it surprises me that we talk so much about just go vote, no matter what, go vote, as if it doesn't matter what you vote, just put your name or, you know, your mark on the ballot, when that's completely wrong, that there's a lot that goes into this because it's complex trying to figure out what is happening on both sides of the arguments of the propositions and what politicians stand for. And so just blanketly telling people to get out to vote, I think, is irresponsible. Unless people have the opportunity or some point in their life where they actually learn how to be informed citizens. And, you know, up until the 1980s, we had mandatory civics education in the schools. As a matter of fact, public education itself was founded on the principle that we needed to have some way of unifying a diverse country of diverse beliefs and cultures and backgrounds, and that by offering a public education, we would have the opportunity to help educate these diverse peoples into one United States citizenry. And part of this education, this public education, was not just to help create an educated working class, but it was also to help educate people about their rights and responsibilities as citizens of the United States. And the idea was that if we had this common experience of what it was to be a citizen, that would help unify the country. And that was promoted through much of public education. It was reaffirmed in 1952, this idea of trying to educate the whole citizen, and not just in your acts as a voter or someone participating in the democracy, but it was also an education about how to run a home, how to take care of the economics of a home, how to save money, you know, how to plan for your future. It was the education of how to read and write, of course, and social science. But in the 1980s, we moved away from all of that and started to focus much more on standardized testing and the opportunity to create a workforce that was prepared to take on the jobs of the 21st century. Much more focused on math and science. We've seen our push towards STEM really as a result of all of this. But the unintended consequences of this movement forward and trying to prepare our young people to go into the workforce, the unintended consequence was letting go and losing those skills that created an educated electorate. And it's also at the point where we start to see this divide in our country, the divisive separation of politics, where people kind of went into their own silos, to use a kind of cliche term, because we stopped engaging at the time where young people were forming their thoughts and beliefs and opinions and values, which are in high school and in college, and creating a space for debate and conversation and discussion, and separated the students out by their academic achievements and created a super competitive environment in the classroom, super competitive environment in the schools that became all about the focus of getting into the highest level of higher education to get the best job. And what's interesting also about this time period, where you would see in the media, in the greater conversation and culture, that we stopped referring to individuals as citizens of the United States, and we saw people referred to as consumers. This is what the consumers want. This is what the consumers demand. This is what the consumers are doing these days. And so it had nothing to do with being informed or participating or being a part of a unified experience. And so that's kind of where my head was today going into the show, that I wanted to talk about how do we educate and inform our electorate so that our elections are more about the greater good and less about voting for our own self-interests. Because that seems to be where we're headed, because we have the ability now with algorithms and social media to create messages that fall right in line with what voters are thinking and believing already. And so people who are running for office or propositions that are trying to get passed, they can meld their message and send it into the mailbox or the news feed of the individuals that speaks to them, their individual self-interest. And if we have an electorate that only votes for their self-interest, then the greater good starts to erode. We start to lose that fabric, that foundation of a united society. And so I guess the question that I'm posing today is, how do we engage young people in the process of being citizens? How do we re-engage an electorate that is getting the same information and not targeted messages that ignite their personal response? And how do we get back to a place where, instead of being so focused on our own personal gain and personal well-being, but being able to step back and realize that when we vote for something, this impacts everyone, either everyone in your community or in your town or in your state or in your country. And are we capable? Are we informed enough or mature enough to step back and cast ballots that support the greater good and maybe not just our personal interest?
I think we also have to have a very cynical eye, especially if you're looking at the advertisements in your mailbox or on your TV set. You have to, is this ad really telling me that if I want to do this, I vote yes? Or is it the opposite?
It's a critical eye have to have.
Yeah, if I want to do this, am I supposed to vote no? And the way the propositions are actually worded, you might vote no if you want something to happen.
Exactly.
And, obviously the TV ads are paid for by the people that want it to pass, so they're going to, I won't say lie to you, but put the best possible spin on things the way they want it to go. So you really need to do your homework and not just pay attention to the commercials. I mean, go to unbiased, go to the text of the amendment and read it.
But then my argument is, should it be that complex as well? Because everything's purposely written in a complex form to keep people confused. And so, my proposal is twofold. I think that we should be seriously considering reducing the voting age to 16. And I'm not the first person to bring this up. As a matter of fact, there are states that are already considering this. In Washington, D.C., for example, they have already passed to the full council a proposition to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in federal elections. And that's going to be up for discussion, I think, in November. And as early as 2020, 16 and 17-year-olds in Washington, D.C. will have the right to vote in federal elections. And in Maryland, there's four cities that have already passed legislation to allow 16-year-olds to vote in local elections. And in Berkeley, California, 16-year-olds and older are allowed to vote for the Board of Education school boards. So I'm not the first one to propose it, and there's been discussions about it in many areas. And so I want to explore that today. And the other reason I'm fired up about this idea is that when I went in to cast my ballot this morning, I walked into the South County polling place, and I was greeted by two high school students, Benito and Jacqueline from Napomo High School. And they were just so beautiful and so bright-eyed, and I'm emotional anyways about today, and I got teary, and you know, I left my absentee ballot, and I walked away, and then I got to the car, and I thought, no, I want to go back and find out why they're here. And so I walked back in, and I asked them, you know, what brought you to be doing this today, because it's a school day, and they're out working at their polling place. And they both said enthusiastically that they were students of Mr. Deichler at Napomo High School. He teaches U.S. AP U.S. History, and it was part of an extracurricular or extra credit project, and they volunteered for it. And they were just so proud to be there, and I was so excited to have them there. And I asked them both, do you wish you could be voting in this election? And they said, yes, of course, because we talk about these things and study these things in our classes, and it'd be great to be able to have a say, especially because we're young and the things that people are voting on are going to impact our future, even more so than their future. So I came home and I called Mr. Deichler's voicemail at Napomo High School and left a message and just wanted to give him some love and say thank you for doing this in your class and getting your students involved and getting them excited about the process of voting and being a part of their civic duties. And if you would be so kind, I would love to have you call in and talk about what inspired you. So Mr. Deichler will be calling in to share his experiences and from this perspective of a teacher, because although civics education funding was federally eliminated in 2011, we see the civics education cropping up by the efforts of teachers in different areas. So that's where we're going today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We'll be opening up the phone lines at 805-781-3875. We also invite you to be part of the conversation by joining our Facebook group, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also find previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show through Apple Podcasts or NPR One. Hit subscribe. You can leave a review to open up the show to more people. I'm excited for this conversation. I'm excited to hear your thoughts. And it's a beautiful day to celebrate being citizens of the United States of America.
The heart is a bloom, shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck. The reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you could lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful day.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we are talking about citizenship and our civic duties and the right to vote as part of our civic duties, but not our only civic duty. And so I thought to put things in context, I would remind us, I'm sure all of you already know this, what the rights and responsibilities are for those of us who are citizens of the United States. And I went to the Citizenship Resource Center to look up what the rights and responsibilities were. And this is the information that's given to people who are seeking to become citizens of the United States. So the rights that you earn as a citizen of the United States are the freedom to express yourself, the freedom to worship as you wish, the right to a fair trial by jury, the right to vote in elections for public officials, the right to apply for federal employment, the right to run for elected office. In the Declaration of Independence, we are given the right to the freedom to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. although we may know all of our rights, I don't know if we think about what our responsibilities are as citizens. And I think if we really did honor our responsibilities, we'd have a much different tenor in our culture today. And here are the responsibilities. We have a responsibility to support and defend the Constitution. We have a responsibility to stay informed on the issues affecting our communities. We have a responsibility to participate in the democratic process. We have a responsibility to respect the rights, beliefs, and opinions of others. We have a responsibility to participate in our local community. We have a responsibility to pay our taxes honestly and on time. That's as it's written on the website. We have the responsibility to serve on a jury when called upon, and we have a responsibility to defend the country if the need should arise. So how are you doing with your responsibility piece of your citizenship? And how do we learn our rights and responsibility of citizens or as citizens if we don't have mandatory civics education in our schools today? And as I mentioned, in 2011, all federal funding for civics and social studies was eliminated. But in 2012, there was a study that was done that showed that 39 states still required at least one course in American government or civics, although only 8 of them were testing students for their proficiency. But there has been this quiet consistency of teachers across the country who, although social studies has been reduced and math and science has been increased, they're still trying to offer civics education. So, as I mentioned, I met two students this morning, Benito and Jacqueline from Napomo High School, and they are students of Mr. Deichler, who teaches U.S. AP Government and U.S. AP U.S. History. And Mr. Deichler was kind enough to call in and talk about his experience teaching young children today, young adults, about their citizenry. Mr. Deichler, hi, you're on the air. Are you there?
I am.
Hi. So thank you.
Good
so
afternoon.
Thank you for calling in after a long day of teaching, and I know you went and voted.
I did.
So I was hoping you could start off talking about why you became a teacher, why a high school teacher at this time. Because teaching is getting there's a lot of people that are leaving teaching and feeling like it's not a career worth following anymore. So what brought you into this?
I think education is a important outlet for people who are looking to commit time to trying to develop their community. My mom was a principal's secretary, so I kind of grew up around schools and from the administrative point of view. And my mentors growing up were teachers and coaches. I really like summer vacation as well, so it seemed like a pretty viable job coming out of college.
And how did you end up at the high school level?
I think in the teacher education programs in California, you get to kind of dip your toes into like what grade levels you think that you might be good at. I substitute taught for a year and taught every grade from K through 12. And so in my training at Cal Poly and my subbing, 11th and 12th grade seemed to be the best fit, so that's what I pursued.
And so how long have you been teaching at Napomo High School?
This is my 12th year.
And how do you approach civics in your classes? And is
so
it
I
part of
AP U.S. History and AP Government? Mm-hmm. But my collegiate background was in marketing, so like a business background, mm-hmm. and I come from a really, really small rural town, Lewiston, California, in far northern California, where my parents own their own business and stuff. So they're, with my background and my education, I like to approach social studies from a history and standards point of view, but also from like a personal finance, personal responsibility, personal accountability type of point of view. Mm-hmm. So we teach everything from how to fill out your taxes to, why the branches of the government will form the way they do. So we just try to give them a more well-rounded look at social studies and civics.
And how did you find an interest, in talking about voting and civics and your responsibility as a citizen? Is this something that your parents taught you or modeled, or was it something you learned when you went through school? Like, how did you decide that this was important?
Yeah, so my parents are, like, neither of them graduated from college, but they were, like, they're pretty passionate about what they do. One of the things that they're very passionate about is just democracy. They love the news. They love the idea of voting and being a participant in government. My mom, I tell my students this every year, my mom in 2016 checked off her bucket list that she was the first person to vote in her precinct, and that was like something she'd always wanted to do. So we grew up around, watching the news around the dinner table back in the 90s when broadcast news was fairly popular. And my parents, like I said, ran their own business, so they were deeply involved in sort of like local politics and sort of like the bureaucracy of local businesses. My mom was the president of the local school board. Involved in the community, involved in everything that they were doing. And so, being excited about voting and excited about, Tuesdays in November was commonplace in my family.
And do you think that my idea, the proposal, not just my idea, but the proposal to lower the voting age to 16 is something that would be viable given your experience teaching 16 and 17 year olds?
So I think that there's two questions there. Like, do I think that 16 year olds would be able to vote? I think absolutely. If we follow what happened with the march against guns and the march against violence last year, clearly we have 16 and 17 year olds in this country that are willing to dive into politics and make educated decisions. At the same time, I teach 16 and 17 year olds who are going through lots of different, growth, I think is a good way of putting it. Mm-hmm. As young people. And I don't necessarily think that all of them would be willing or able to make, all of the decisions. One of the issues with 16 and 17 year olds voting is that they don't have a lot of experience with taxes, for example. They don't realize that they pay taxes on a regular basis when they're filling up their gas tank or whatever, but they also don't realize that, they don't know very much about income tax or, like, how things impact their wallets because they don't really know that responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so that's, that's just one example of something that is regularly on ballots that they might struggle with voting on just for lack of experience. I think that in California, we don't have a mandatory ninth grade social studies class. Mm-hmm. So in eighth grade, they learn about U.S. history, and then in ninth grade, they learn about driver's ed. And so since we skip social studies for a year at the high school level, we find that in, like, 10th grade, there's definitely there's a step back that kids have taken in their civic education. So you would definitely have to look at changing some of the structure of like what you teach in schools, I think, for sure.
And because we don't have formal civics education, how do you weave the lessons of the responsibilities of participating in your democracy and respecting the rights and beliefs of others? How do you weave those citizenship duties into your course curriculum?
You just do it. You as seamlessly as possible, I guess, is the answer. So, like, around tax season, for example, there's always a handful of juniors and seniors that have jobs that are having to fill out income taxes for the first time. So one of the things that I learned in high school, back in the 90s when there was civics education, or at least it was more prominent before No Child Left Behind, was that we learned how to fill out tax forms. That was something I did in my civics class. Mm-hmm. And so I bring in stuff that I learned, and I just try to weave it in a timely fashion. So we've been talking about propositions and taxes and having conversations with your parents right now because you can't vote if you're 16, but maybe you can, have conversations, like find out what your parents are doing. Like, do they have opinions? Are they going out to the polls and kind of see what's going on? From, like, a larger community standpoint, finding out what a lot of these kids are pretty involved in community anyway. But having conversations about, things that are positive, whether in, like, our area, like beach cleanups, for example, are pretty popular and positive. And just doing things to, like, help the community. We have a huge following for, like, Special Olympics, Best Buddies and stuff in our campus as well. So our kids are pretty devoted to trying to develop their community the best they can.
And so Benito and Jacqueline that I met this morning, how did you get them involved in volunteering for the election day?
So this was something I came upon in 2016. We got a local email to a local social studies teacher saying that they were accepting student volunteers. And so I presented to the class and I pitched it to the class. And I had a handful of students go participate. They had a phenomenal experience. So I knew in 2018 when there was going to be another election that I was going to like push this super hard. So I presented it to all the classes. I offered them some extra credit as long as they went and they worked and they presented and they did all the things they have to do. So like tomorrow they'll have to do presentations in class on the whole process. But I just think it's super cool. It was something that I wish I could have done when I was 16. But our precinct was so small in our little town. I don't think they needed more than like one or two people to run it anyway. It's just a really cool opportunity. And I think that's a way to get kids involved and get kids thinking about the right things to do. So.
Yeah, I want to thank you, Mr. Deichler, for taking the time to get your kids involved and even recognizing that voting and being a part of the election is an important part of being a part of the community. And I appreciate the time because I know that teachers are overworked, overwhelmed with lots of testing and standards that you have to meet, and to include some of your personal interests and things that you know are of value to your kids, I think takes a lot of extra energy. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, no worries.
Thank you for calling in. And I want to debate this idea of the 16-year-olds not being able to understand taxes as we get closer to getting the proposition on the ballot, because I think, honestly, that reducing the voting age to 16 is probably the only way that we're going to educate our overall electorate on how it is to vote, how to get out to the polls, how to read the ballots. If we don't teach it in school in our public education, I don't know where else they're going to learn that information once they're out of school. So
I would definitely say, just as like a point as well, one of the struggles with the American system is that we have teenagers that graduate at 18, but that turn 18 after November, by and large. And so what we have is, you know, civics education or social studies education in government classes and economics classes, teaching kids, you know, about the government, maybe about voting, about community responsibility, but that won't be able to participate in voting until the following year or maybe even 2 years out. And because, again, that's a huge gap of time, they're not necessarily like dialed in. At 16, they're in public school, and so they're super dialed in. So there could definitely be some benefits.
And they're excited about life and their future still, and I think that's important to capitalize on, that we need to capture young people while they still have great faith and hope in the future to feel like they have some power in the direction that their world is going. Because I think it's that sense of being powerless that throws a lot of young people off as they move out of adolescence into young adulthood.
Oh yeah, adulthood's super hard. So when they get into the real world, and they have to deal with, you know, responsibility and problems, you know, oftentimes voting in a local election is definitely on the back burner compared to, you know, like keeping a job or finding their first job or whatever. So
yeah,
that definitely is the case.
Well, thank you for being a positive influence, and thanks for taking the time to call in today.
Absolutely.
Take care, Mr. Deichler. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. We're talking about voting and Election Day. And I've proposed that we seriously consider reducing the voting age to 16 from 18. Because it's interesting, the voting age of 18 is kind of a random number. It wasn't based on the idea that we become adults at 18, that something changes fundamentally in our brain. Actually, if we wanted to be strictly scientific about it, our adult brain doesn't fully evolve until the age of 25. But we give young people responsibilities at the age of 18, adult responsibilities, though we also give adult responsibilities at the age of 16. The 16-year-olds can get jobs, and they're paying taxes on those jobs, and they're vested in the culture and community. They're going to public schools, and so the education that they're receiving will impact their future as adults. And so 16-year-olds are as vested in the future as 18-year-olds. And the only reason 18-year-olds have the right to vote was because of the amendment, the 26th Amendment that was passed and ratified in 1971. And here's the interesting thing about the 26th Amendment, which is the right of citizens of the U.S. who are 18 years or older to vote, was that it was not a popular idea at all to lower the voting age to 18, but the Vietnam War was going on and it was a very unpopular war and the draft age was 18. And so citizens were arguing that if you're going to send young people off to the war at 18, then they certainly should be able to vote in elections that are going to determine what they have, what's going to happen in their lives. And so this amendment was proposed in 1971, right before the 1972 elections that President Nixon was very nervous about. So he ratified that change very quickly. So the 26th Amendment, lowering the voting age to 18, was really about the political climate of the time. Just as the suffragist movement and the 20th Amendment, giving women the right to vote, was also a result of 80 years of constant pressure from the electorate that kept responding to the dragging of the feet of those in power who finally realized that this was a random discrimination against women and the quiet resolve of women to keep pointing out the ways that they were already participating in government by going into the workforce in World War I and World War II and having responsibilities within the family, that it became apparent that women were as participatory in the culture as men, and that was part of what helped force the passing of the 19th Amendment. So the laws we have, the amendments we've passed about voting, aren't really based on anything scientific or biological. They're really based on social pressure. And if we want to engage young people in hope for the future or in what's going to happen to their lives moving forward, then I argue that we should be considering lowering that voting age, as already is happening in some places around the country. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. We are talking about voting, and we would love to hear your comments, questions, concerns about this issue. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to continue this conversation.
This is the Roosevelt Room, where issues are discussed. Pull up a chair. Your meeting. Well, I'm saying all societies distinguish between an adult phase of life with inherent rights and childhood as a time of development when those rights are curtailed.
But the 26th Amendment, lowering the voting age to 18, proves the line is arbitrary, or at least fluid.
There's a call for you.
In the 30 years since the 26th passed, society has not much altered its stance on when adulthood begins.
18 is still the common age of graduation from school, military, conscription.
What about children as young as 12 get tried for crimes as adults? So I'm mature enough to face sentencing as a full citizen, but not to vote?
Well, you can be pretty dumb and commit a crime. Voting requires a level of reasoning.
Adults don't have to prove any level of reasoning to vote.
Nor should they.
Okay, I'll cede that, but would you agree children need special protections against coercion and mistreatment by adults?
Sure.
Those same vulnerabilities make them unable to vote independently.
That argument, immature logic.
And being easy to coerce.
That argument was used to prevent Negroes and women from voting up until the 20th century.
Sorry, CJ's looking for you. Your next meeting.
Dining and dancing.
And your parents call from District Pizza. You guys are missing dinner.
So you might recognize that as a clip from The West Wing. Again, I'm not the first one who's proposed this idea of lowering the voting age to 16. It's actually was proposed on that show, but also in classrooms around the country. Berkeley, California has allowed 16 and 17-year-olds to vote for the school board. Then Tacoma Park in Maryland and a few other cities in Maryland, they have lowered the voting age to 16 and 17 for local elections. And Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, their city has got a bill that's moved into the full council to open up voting to 16 and 17-year-olds in federal elections maybe by 2020. So what do you think about that? And what do you think about this returning of civics education to our classrooms? Because if we don't teach citizenship in our classes, when will our young people learn them? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. Charlie, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Okay, yeah, about voting. I was in high school when they were talking about lowering the voting age to 18, and he didn't think 18-year-olds were mature enough, and I reminded him we could get had to register for the draft.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think doesn't California allow registration to vote at age 17?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Actually, while I was in college, I turned 21 when I was my senior year in college, and what I did as soon as I was 21, I registered to vote, and my first vote was an absentee voter ballot for a school board.
And you still remember it, so it must have been an important day for you.
Yeah. See, my mom turned 21 when women had the right to vote, and she was proud that she was voted in every election that she was physically able to get to. There were 13 years there out of the country at a time in Iran that voting overseas was more cumbersome. But yeah, my parents voted in every election.
And I think that, thank you, Charlie, for calling. I think that you give a great example of how we pass along the values of being a citizen and the skills of actually being an educated voter, that we learn that from the model of our parents. We learn that by what we see in our homes growing up. But we also learn that from our public education system that, as I mentioned, was designed to help create a fully educated and thriving citizenry. And so without a full array of skills being taught in public education, if our home isn't teaching us how to vote, how to read ballots, how to be discerning, how to critically think about issues, and again, to think outside of our own personal interests, but maybe consider the greater good, because we aren't islands in this country. We aren't islands unto ourselves and just our family. We share this community. We share these cities. We share this country. And so we have to think about the greater good. And that's really hard. That's a hard concept for a lot of people to cope with, because when you vote for the greater good, then there are people who will be hurt by the impact of that vote. But sometimes we have to make tough decisions that are going to move along the greater good of the country that we belong to. So what do you think about that? And when you think about your rights as a citizen, do you think about your responsibilities as well? And are you keeping up with your responsibilities to support and defend the Constitution, to stay informed on the issues affecting your community, to participate in the democratic process? You know, if you say I'm apolitical and I don't participate in the political process and it doesn't, you know, it's not something I want to get wrapped up in, then you're already failing three of your responsibilities as a citizen of the United States. And then how about respecting the rights, beliefs, and opinions of others, or participating in your local community by volunteering or being a part of committee or different local actions? Where are you in your responsibilities as a citizen? I think about mine all the time because there's areas that I'm really waning in my responsibilities and probably need to step up. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. Rosemary, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, we start learning to vote at a very young age. I remember voting at age 10 for who was going to be president and treasurer of our campfire group.
Mm-hmm.
And then in high school, we had a Cairo club at church and a service club in the high school, Tri-High Y. And we voted for officers. I mean, we took this seriously. And when I was going to high school, in 1960, civics was compulsory back then. And because I had been elected to an office, an executive board position, I had to take civics in the summer since the executive board was going to be my other period in the fall. And we had to go to a city hall. I mean, besides the textbook, which was quite big, we had to go to a city hall meeting and a school board meeting and write a report. And then we, for extra credit, we could go to a board of supervisors meeting, which, of course, for me was all the way into Los Angeles. So I had to take a bus into Los Angeles to watch what the board of supervisors do. And then because it was 1960 and the Democrats were having a convention in L.A., we could go to a platform committee. Now, I don't think they even have those open to the public. It is pretty boring. But I thought it was fascinating because I'd never seen anything like that. And Mr. Galanio just was one of the hardest teachers you could get in social studies. But I was so glad I'd had civics. It was like I knew so much more at the end of that class. And because I'd only become a citizen at age 14, it meant more to me to know about the country. And because my mom and dad had had to take all these classes in night school, I'd heard topics. One of the funny things about 1960 is we had a mock election that fall.
Oh, all of a sudden I lost Rosemary. I'm sorry. Rosemary, please call back in because I want to hear the rest of your story. Because I'm curious to know how old you were when you held that first public office, and have you continued to be a part of your community or hold offices? Because, you know, all social organizations or volunteer organizations have board of directors, they have different offices that people hold. And I'm curious, you know, how many of you have participated in your own democratic process in volunteer groups that you belong to? Because it's interesting, not only have we seen kind of decline in active citizen participation since the 1960s and more so since the 1980s, we see that also correlate with a decline in recreation outside of the home, that people would work during the day and then the evenings they'd go to Rotary Club meetings or Elks Club meetings or Bridge Club or Hearing League or Junior League or different volunteer groups, or they'd be in their bowling league or their softball league, that people were much more active outside of the home in the evenings in their community. And by being involved in community activities, by participating in different sporting leagues and volunteer leagues and community leagues, people got to know each other, that your next door neighbor was familiar to you, that your grocer was familiar to you, that you had your, you know, adversaries' children play on your sports teams and got to know each other through Little League instead of standing, you know, opposite each other on an issue at a school board meeting. And so part of the breakdown of our understanding of how to engage as citizens and look towards the greater good has coincided with kind of the breakdown of our extracurricular activities outside of the home in the evening. And what's unfortunate is that it's not that people don't want to participate or be involved in things outside of their home in the evenings. The way we work as individuals has changed, that many people are working two or three jobs that keep them away from home for all hours. They don't have an evening free. They don't get home from work at 5 o'clock, have dinner, and then go out from 7 to 9 to an event, that people aren't getting home from work till 7 to 9. And if you watch and follow kind of the trend, this all leads back to the two things that happened in the 1980s, where we saw a shift away from recreation and engagement outside of the home, and we saw an increase in the amount of work that people took on. And we saw that shift from the terminology of citizen regarding to citizens of the United States to consumers. And once we became consumers in the eyes of the culture, then the amount of work we had to do to keep up with our consumption habits made it very difficult to keep participating in volunteer organizations and community leadership groups. And without those, how do we stay engaged with each other as a culture and as a community? And I don't have an answer for this. I just step back quite often and look in from the outside at how we got to where we are today and how it's impacting our lives and our families and our mental health and well-being. And if you step back, you can see how we got to the place where we are and maybe see how we can take a few steps back to make a correction to engage more people in the process of being informed and active citizens. 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. And Carmen, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. So I'm from Paso, and I just graduated high school, and so I experienced learning about being civically engaged just recently and during the election of 2016. And so I think it's very different what maybe other folks have experienced, especially maybe older generations. But personally, I think that being civically engaged only comes with if you come from a privileged background. Mm-hmm. I think the system is tailored to exploit people of color and marginalized voices. And so I think upholding that system and continuing to take part in the political process is continuing that exploitation of those people. And so I think we need to look at how our political process is run and how we support capitalism and look at how we can dismantle that and fix that so it's not built by, like, because right now our Constitution was, it was written by slave owners, and it was written by colonizers, and so I think we need to look at how we can rewrite that and how we can open up this system so it's not just tailored towards, like, white wealthy people.
But how do we get there, Carmen, if without the electoral system? How do we bypass that?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that I think that we need to look at not having a democracy. And I know that, like, kind of sounds scary because we've had a democracy for so long, but, like, looking at something that's, like, maybe more of a republic or, like, a socialist, like, obviously socialism is not, like, they go hand in hand, democracy and socialism, and so that may be something we can look at. But I definitely think that we need to rewrite the Constitution, and I don't, it's hard to, like, look at which way we can do that right now because it's so tailored towards, like, these white congressmen who are, like, running our country. And so it's, like, almost impossible to do. But, like, if we don't, like, our planet is going to be killed, and, like people are just going to be continued to be, like, essentially, like, slaves to the system. So
I appreciate your passion because I clearly you have energy about this and wanting to bring about change. I love that. But I just want to throw something out for you to consider, because if you look at our Constitution, there have been amendments all along the way to try to correct some of the ways that maybe the original Declaration of Independence or Constitution, you know, only supported a small minority group of people who wrote those original laws. You know, the 15th Amendment opened up the right to vote to all of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So that was, you know, the right to vote for the slaves after the Civil War. Unfortunately, it didn't include women. So we had the 19th Amendment that guaranteed the right to vote for women, which was ratified in 1920. And then, as I mentioned, then in 1971, the 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18. So there are ways to take that original document and those original ideas and to make changes moving forward, to maybe, to propose an amendment about protecting the environment that becomes part of the Constitution.
Yeah, and I think that those amendments really spurred a lot of progress, and I think those are really great, but, like, women still can't vote, and, like black men are still being criminalized and basically enslaved, like, through the prison system. So I don't know necessarily if, like, writing a law almost makes it seem like we don't even address that problem now because we're, like, we have these amendments, we've solved this, like, let's move on. When there's, like, so many other parts of that, there's, like, already, like, segregation in our cities. And I think we need to explore, like there's only so many, like, there would be an impossible amount of amendments that we would have to write to correct the system because it's so, so broken.
And I'm sad that you feel, because you're young, you're just fresh out of high school.
Yeah.
I'm sad that you feel that you're swimming so far upstream. But what I'm encouraged by is that you sound like someone who graduated from high school in 1966 and had that same energy and that same sense that, you know, things are going to hell and we need to have radical change. And then we took those steps through in the revolutions of the 60s and we've backslid quite a bit over the last few decades, but that energy is there again. And so I guess I'm encouraging you to find ways within that system to make change while on the outside of the system continuing to find alternatives. And so the two are happening hand in hand because we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. We have to work with what we've got until the new system emerges. Would you agree?
Yes, of course. And I think obviously that's why you should vote today. But, like, also remember that, like, tomorrow you should organize. So
yes.
I think that's, like, something we need to keep in mind. But, I mean, yeah, obviously we have to work with the system we have because, like, people are dying. So, but, yeah.
Stay positive, Carmen. Keep that energy up, my
okay.
friend. I'm serious
okay,
because
you.
Your energy is the future. And there are a lot of people who feel that same energy. And if you can find each other in any way possible, change will come. I have great hope for that. Thanks for calling in, Carmen. Yes. Thanks
yes.
for calling.
Have a nice day.
You too. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I like the energy. Where do we keep infusing young people with the ability to have hope for the future? That goes back to my argument of lowering that voting age to 16, because we have an epidemic level of young people who are feeling listless and alienated, getting caught up in drug abuse, dropping out of school, feeling kind of lost. And what if we were to infuse their lives at 16 and 17 with this sense of ownership and opportunities within their government to teach them about their rights and their responsibilities? If we taught every 16 and 17 year old that they had a responsibility to participate in the democratic process, that they had to respect the rights and beliefs of others, to participate in their local community, to serve on juries with pride, if we infuse them with these opportunities and the right to vote, we would dissuade a lot of negative mental health issues. We would help reduce a lot of anxiety and depression that young people feel if they felt like they had a voice in politics. But that's just me. 805-781-3875. Hi, Rick. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
I'd like to address some of the issues that you and the previous caller raised, because a lot of young people think that things have been the way they are right now just continually because they've been that way ever since they were born. Mm-hmm. But up until, as you pointed out, 1980, there was really a lot of progress and there was a lot of unification in the country and a lot of political activity on the part of young people. But when Ronald Reagan came into power, his motto was to run government like business. Mm-hmm. And it made the whole thing susceptible to policies that basically favored business, but he claimed they would benefit everybody, but in fact they benefited business and very wealthy people at the expense of the general public. And the right wing began dumbing down America and dismantling, as you were pointing out, like some of the education and other programs that were really necessary for people to be able to function well. Mm-hmm. So I think young people need to understand, well, the whole country needs to understand that the experiment that was started by Reagan, which he claimed was going to benefit everybody, has really been a disaster. And that not only politically, but economically, our national debt is totally a result of those policies that were put into place and have been pressed and maintained by the Republicans ever since. And we need a huge reversal if we're going to get this country to work right.
Yeah, I thank you, Rick. I think it's a matter also of rewriting the story or retelling the story again, refabilizing what it is to be the United States of America. Because I think you're right, there was a shift in the 80s where we went from being a country of citizens to a country of consumers, and those policies followed suit. But we can't say our way out of it as long as we keep believing the same story to be true, which is our might and wealth is wrapped up in what we manufacture and how much money we make. You know, we have to start with changing the story. I appreciate you calling and bringing that up, because those are the conversations that help open us up to where we're going in the future. Clem, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Well, if you lower it to age to 16,
yes,
are they going to be making a decision how they vote, or will their parents or a relative or a friend be doing it for them?
Well, you know, I don't know, because I think that we all get information from family members or friends or wherever we go to seek out information. Husbands uh-huh. and wives talk to each other about how they're going to vote.
Uh-huh.
You know,
Well, on a city council, sometimes it's only about 14 or 15 votes to decide I'm losing or winning.
Absolutely.
So that can make a difference if your parents are going to say, well, we prefer this person, mm-hmm. vote for them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
That's all.
Well, thank you, Clem. And it's interesting because I remember my first election in 1980, and I didn't know much about politics. I know that we took civics, but I don't think I paid enough attention or really was engaged in it. And I remember just kind of voting along the lines of my parents, going to them and saying, how does this all work? I remember walking some walking door to door with my mom for a couple campaigns that she was involved in. But I really was a product of my parents' voting rights and experience and beliefs at that time. And I think that's true for most young people until they get to a certain point where they leave home or they have experiences outside of their family and we start to make decisions separate from our family. But today, I hope you think about what it is to be a citizen, not just our rights to vote and our rights for freedom of expression and our rights to worship, but also our responsibilities, and pay attention to how you're participating and being responsible for your citizenship in this country. Support and defend the Constitution. Stay informed on the issues affecting your community. Participate in the democratic process. Show up to meetings. Show up to events. Respect the rights, beliefs, and opinions of others. Participate in your local community. Pay your taxes honestly and on time. Serve on a jury when called upon, because how many people rush out of trying to participate in their jury duty, and then defend the country if the need should arise. As always, we appreciate you being a part of the conversation and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Find me on my Facebook page or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, and we'll be back next week to continue the conversation.
Godfather.
Payback.
Cold blood.